For over 10 years, VOC Nation has taken listeners behind the scenes of the greatest moments in pro wrestling history. Our hosts are not only experts on the business, but have lived in the business. Subscribe and hear weekly podcasts from hosts like legendary pro wrestling journalist Bill Apter, former Impact Wrestling star Wes Briscoe, former WWE and AWA broadcaster Ken Resnick, former WWE and TNA star Shelly Martinez, former WCW star The Maestro, NWA legend The Raging Bull Manny Fernandez, and much more. VOC Nation programming is free on most major podcasting apps, including iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, and Radio.com. And video podcast and bonus content is available on Patreon for as low as $3 a month. What are you waiting for? Head to VOCNation.com and dig into the most comprehensive podcast network built for pro wrestling fans. Find us on Facebook and Instagram at VOC Nation Wrestling Network and follow us on Twitter at VOC Nation.
That's pretty exciting, right, Omega?
Indeed.
Yeah, right.
HISD Talk Radio is always exciting.
And you're listening to Hell in a Cell Radio.
Hell in a Cell Talk Radio.
Hell in a Cell Radio.
Hell in a Cell Talk Radio.
Hell in a Cell Talk Radio.
It's Hall of Fame weekend, or week. I'm so mixed up with what's happening. Hall of Fame week, which means I don't dress up. Craig, of course, dresses up. He's got to compete with certain people in wrestling to keep the best dressed in wrestling, but here we are. I am technically wearing a Hall of Fame jersey.
Yes, you are.
Yeah, thank you. But welcome to HISD Talk Radio. I'm Dan. That's Craig. Dan Law 83. Craig Lagan. Not real hard to figure out. We'll go over that at the end of the show. Before we get into the WWE Network on Peacock, you had not an apology, but a correction or an amendment or somebody followed up on our AWA Bernie Gagne kind of scathing rant the other day and wanted to follow up on somebody reaching out to you about something.
Yes, Dan, thank you. 2 weeks ago, you know, we were talking about the WWE and the AWA, and I brought up that there were two types of racism. Now the WWE has a plethora of black wrestlers and black superstars, but at the same time they've played on racial stereotypes with black people. They've had white wrestlers dress up in blackface. They've had Tony Atlas dress up as a African warrior with spear and everything. And they've even tried to pass a white wrestler off as black, Akeem. Okay, so that's one form of racism. I mentioned that the other form that was a non-inclusive part of racism, because we 2 weeks ago it was the anniversary of the passing of Ernie Ladd,
yeah.
And I pointed out how huge Ernie Ladd was, not just in physical stature, but his presence in American wrestling in the United States, and how he drew everywhere, and how he's a main event talent, and how he was one of the greatest heels of the 70s of any color. Period.
Yeah. Bar none.
Yet he never set foot in the AWA. And for the record, I never called Vern Gagne a racist.
No, I didn't either.
Yeah, what I was pointing out that for as popular and not even as a heel, as in demand and as sought out and as reliable a big money draw as Ernie Ladd was in every major territory.
I'm not laughing at you, by the way.
Arena in the United States, he never set foot in the AWA. Well, someone pointed out to me, and they were correct, because I had forgotten that a person of color did have a good run in the AWA, and it was Peter Maivia. And the very first time I ever saw Peter Maivia was in an After magazine in 1976 during an AWA title match with Nick Bockwinkel. And in the official rankings, he was ranked number 2 behind Vern, and he had a good run. After that run, he went to the WWF, and he had classic match with Superstar,
yeah.
Turned heel and had a classic run with Bob Backlund. After that, he went west and founded his own company, and the rest is history. And someone else pointed out that at the tail end of his career, Jimmy Snuka also had a run in the AWA when his feud with Colonel De Beers.
Yeah, but isn't that kind of like saying, well, I have a black friend?
Well, what I pointed out to this person was, you're right, they are both people of color. One's Fijian and one's Samoan, but what they are not is black.
Black.
Yeah, and while I singled out Ernie Ladd only because of his immense popularity and his immense drawing power, that would be an asset to any federation, territory, NWA, WWF, but Bull Bob Reveal never wrestled in the AWA. Thunderball Patterson never wrestled in the AWA. Rocky Johnson never wrestled in the AWA. Tony Atlas never wrestled in the AWA. So that's the point that's the original point I was making. And you very astutely pointed out, while all these men that I just named were main event talent in every place they wrestled, in every territory they wrestled, yet never set foot in the AWA, and you astutely pointed out that makes Bron Gagne either a racist or an idiot. Pick one. Because
I was saying idiot, by the way.
Yes. Yeah, and his idiocy has been very well documented, especially during the documentary.
For a while there, AWA was a juggernaut, but he didn't adapt.
No.
He didn't adapt to anything, whether it be including anything other than white wrestlers, mm-hmm. certainly lacking in the female wrestling territory, but everybody was those days.
Yeah.
As far as the big, you know what I mean.
Yes.
And by the way, we accept the criticism, please, because we love interaction. But I just can't believe anybody's ever even interacting. Thank you.
Yes.
But towards the end, he was incapable of adapting.
Yes.
Maybe saying he was an idiot is probably most likely harsh, but I was trying to drive home the point that he didn't fucking adapt. To the stuff that was happening in front of him, clear as day.
Yeah.
Kind of idiotic.
And even other wrestlers will attest to it. Jerry Lawler, chief among them. And when he was here in Philadelphia on wrestling radio with Joe Goodhart, and he was talking about how he made last-ditch efforts to Vern when he was the AWA champion, and they entered an agreement with World Class and with Tennessee. So all three of them could work together in, you know, interchanging talent and, you know, keeping each one of their territories alive since they were getting swallowed whole by the WWF and WCW. So Jerry pointed out that we can just make all three of us, you know, under the AWA umbrella, Memphis, World Class, USWA, we can make that our own little thing. Vern said no. And Jerry Lawler pointed out, you know, you can have the greatest idea in the world, but if Vern didn't think of it, that's not the greatest idea in the world. So it was after that, shortly after that, when Jerry left the company, he left to help the AWA title up because he was like, I'm going to be fine. I've got Memphis, and the WWF will be calling, and he didn't know this, but within a year, so he would be okay. And because Vince McMahon was in great standing with Jerry Jarrett, Jerry Lawler was going to be okay, no matter what. But he was trying to help out Vern. Because Vern gave him a shot to be the AWA world champion, something that, you know, was hurting business because Jerry Lawler would get these shots at all these world champions, namely in the NWA, and knowing that he would never get a run at the NWA title, no matter how well he drew against Harley Race, Jack Briscoe, Ric Flair, what have you, Terry Funk, chief among them, he wasn't going to get a run. In the AWA, he would. He would have a better shot, and he proved them right, and he was AWA champion and a great drawing AWA champion, and bringing in other federations would have helped everyone out. But Vern said no because, like you said, he didn't adapt. He couldn't adapt.
He was incapable of adapting, which by definition in those days is pretty idiotic looking about what was going on around him.
Yeah, and that was Vern in the 90s. I was pointing out in the 70s when you could have used these wrestlers of color that I named that drew everywhere in the United States that could have done nothing but help your company, since these guys did nothing but help everyone else. And it's not like Ernie was ever going to go over. He was not going to be AWA champion. He would
he wasn't that kind of guy. It was
no.
He got it.
Yeah, and you pointed out 2 weeks ago, and he said, "Do you think Ernie would have had a problem with Vern or that?" And Ernie worked for and with so many different promoters and bookers from Vince Sr. to Eddie Graham to Bill Watts to Ole Anderson to the Sheik, if he can manage all those different personalities and not have a problem with any of them, and they never had a problem with him because he kept coming back to these territories and making both of them money, why would he have a problem with Vern? Or why would Vern have a problem with him, since his whole job is to come in there, get tremendous heat, have a big match. I win the first one, first month, I win by count out. Second one, double DQ. Third one, blow off match, I put you over, I leave. On to the next one. That's what he did in every territory he went. That's what he did with Pedro. That's what he did with Bruno. He could have done that with Vern easily. But to the person who pointed that out to me about Peter Mivey and Jimmy Snuka, you are correct. I overlooked them. I was saying that I was specifically saying because of the death of Ernie Lather, Ernie, as successful as he was, never wrestled in the AWA. And the person who ran AWA never had any popular or even hated black wrestlers on his roster at any point, and that's all I was saying. But thank you for pointing it out that it was that Peter Mivey and Jimmy Snuka, the two wrestlers of color, had successful runs in the AWA. And I sit suited corrected.
Sort of.
They still weren't black, but
they weren't black. But my point stands, and again, I will hold fast about the Vern thing, discrediting everything you did before that. At a certain point, that's just me. At a certain point, you have to learn to let go.
Yeah,
and we'll see what the summer holds. But at this point, I'm going to have to let it go, and that's the WWE Network. Because it sucks on Peacock. It sucks.
Yeah, you said it.
And I'm not talking about lack of content. Mm-hmm. In the grand scheme of things, I can live without. You know, they're telling me it eventually will be there. We already had a discussion on censoring stuff off the network. Mm-hmm. About beating that dead horse, which would probably get cut by Peacock. Even though they're airing a John Wayne Gacy documentary on their network. Sure, cut wrestling. That's fine.
It's more offensive, apparently.
Yes. Pogo the Clown. Okay. But Peacock has a great layout. The app works great. But there's no features. You can't pause it and come back.
Nope.
Well, you can't stop it. There's no chapters. You can't stop it, leave, come back, press play, it'll be in the same spot. It's Vince McMahon needed some money, and he made the deal. And the only people that are losing out are wrestling fans. And now, this is not for I'm not speaking for everybody, because there are a lot of wrestling fans who don't care about the old archive stuff that this is not affecting. Mm-hmm. And we'll watch it live without breaks, which I just can't and won't do anymore. And so I guess we're in the minority, present company included, Craig. Thank you. I wanted to get to it before you did. Thank you. The rollout's not been great.
No, it hasn't. And I knew that was a problem going in.
I was holding on hope against hope, man.
Yeah. But I said the same thing. You couldn't have waited a year, worked out all the bugs, and then presented it. But no, I need it right now, right before WrestleMania, to do this deal, really, really quickly, to get it out so we can get WrestleMania on Peacock, like right before WrestleMania season. But I don't know what the rush is. It's not like they were cash strapped. It's not like they needed this deal. Wait a year, or wait 6 months. Till SummerSlam, work out all the bugs. Have the SummerSlam be your WrestleMania, and when everyone will be more vaccinated, you can have more people in the stands, and it'll be safer. And I don't know what the rush was. The rush is what's killing it now. The fact that there is nothing that you can't stop it, you can't pause it, you can't pick up where you left off or anything, and why it's such a huge cluster F for wrestling fans, period.
GM Spector's in the room saying, that's really crappy for looking for specific segments for episodes. It's like the old days of trying to fast forward and rewind to find that specific match. Yeah, it's not like I haven't been here before.
Yeah.
But it's like when you're like here, Sheldon's mom is in the room too. Hello. When you're like here's this thing that the rest of the world is going to keep, but you're not going to have it anymore.
No.
For something inferior right now.
Yeah.
I looked up before I said anything. I looked up to see if I missed you asked where these features will come later. And the only thing I found is the stuff that you and I are watching. That stuff will all come later. All the archive stuff, albeit very edited.
Yeah.
It's coming later. But just on live events.
Yeah.
You have TakeOver 1, TakeOver Part 2. You have WrestleMania 1. You have WrestleMania Part 2. You had the Hall of Fame thing. And none of these, it's all gone. None of that feature's there. It's annoying, and it's turned me off to it. I haven't watched any of it yet. I watched the clips on YouTube again. I was ready to bear down, man.
Me too. I've only seen the Hall of Fame clips from Twitter and from Instagram. That's it. Because when I tried, it's like I'm not anywhere close to what I
I'm not interested in looking at any of this, yeah.
No.
Speaking of the Hall of Fame.
Mm-hmm.
Some big things went down last night. Stuff that I've forgotten or didn't know about or wasn't announced. I know there's going to be one you're going to want to talk about. The one I wanted to bring up first, Gary Hart. How is it 2021 and Gary Hart is only in the WWE Hall of Fame now?
That's one of the biggest mysteries of all. That Gary Hart wasn't in any type of Hall of Fame or recognized by the WWE. He's one of the single greatest, not just managers, at which he excelled at. He's always been in my top five, top three or four, but booking minds and a guy that was what now? He's the anti-Byrne because he did see change and he did adapt and go. Gary Hart was the one who was based in Texas with Fritz and saw Fritz bringing in old wrestler after old wrestler for his sons to beat, like Mark Lewins and the Spoilers and the Bull Ramoses. And Gary was like, well, geez, these three young baby faces, Kevin, David, and Kerry, instead of wrestling guys my age and their dad's age, why don't we get them some young heels? Like these guys in Atlanta, the Freebirds, or Chris Adams, or hey, Gino Hernandez, or hey, Jimmy Garvin, you know, to go up against these young baby faces, bring in young heels. And what do you know? He does that, and world class is the biggest money making territory outside of the WWF in 1983-84. Because, again, the forethought, got to adapt, got to roll with it, got to see, look ahead, and not stay with what we were doing. Same thing with this is the anniversary of the debut of the Great Muta on Clash of Champions that he brought in. Same thing with Kabuki and foreign wrestlers. Gary Hart was the man when it comes to foreign wrestlers.
Gary Hart knew. Gary Hart was woke before everybody else was.
Or the Mid Atlantic stuff when Gary Hart. Oh my God. Dan, when Gary Hart in 1984, when Gary Hart managed Ernie Ladd, oh my God, just give them the microphone and just
what?
The whole hour.
I didn't even know that was a thing.
Oh, because it only lasted like a month or so.
That's all I need. Years of material, sir.
Because Ernie was booking there, and Gary came in with Kabuki.
Oh, of course, Ernie was like, "You're my guy." Gary's like, "Yes, I am."
Yes. But to have the both of them talk, man, it's like I gotta tell you something, big brother. He calls him in.
Gary Hart. So GM Spector, that I actually got to see him make a return live for the time he was in MLW for some tapings at a show in downtown Orlando.
Awesome.
When lockdown first happened, MLW was airing some of that.
Okay.
On their YouTube channel. So I was going back and watching the last, kind of some of the last stuff Gary Hart ever did in wrestling before he unfortunately passed away. That, if I had the time machine, first place to go,
yeah,
go interview Gary Hart. And then he quoted, Jim Spector quoted Gary Hart, I can't talk today, which is every day. Kabuki is not a toy. You do not play with him. Did you ever see the interview where Gary Hart introduces Muda as Kabuki's son? I have not seen that.
Yeah, I would say go to the WWE Network, but we both know that.
It ain't going to be there now. It'll be there in August or something.
Yeah.
Gary, I'll say it before Jim Spector, I always like pointing out the first show I ever went to in person was Halloween Havoc 89. You'll send it to me on Twitter. Thank you very much. Jim Spector coming in for the win. But it was Halloween Havoc 89, and the main event, which was refereed by Bruno, was Sting and Ric Flair with Ole Anderson versus Muda and Terry Funk with Gary Hart. That was the main event of the first show I ever went to. It's only like retrospect 15 years later where you're like, holy shit.
Watch history. Or even just watch Gary Hart and Terry Funk during the Terry Funk Ric Flair.
Oh, God, yes.
Yeah.
The Thunderdome Cage, yes, that is the one. The Thunderdome Cage, where it caught fire before the show started. Muda had to climb up, spit it out.
Yeah,
spit out his mist and put the fire out. Thought, you know, we're going to have this cage. It's Halloween Havoc. Let's put some flammable decorations on the side and then turn on the pyro.
Yes, in a building where there's not supposed to be any fire.
Yeah,
whatsoever.
Yeah, in the Civic Center, which, you know, if you sneeze, you're going to knock it down in the first place because it's been there since the 20s. Let's light that on fire.
But Gary Hart going in... incredibly excited, and I know, and they—that's how they sneak it by the legacy win, the legacy wing. My apologies. They'll announce all their quota filled for their WWE Hall of Fame every year. We got to put in a tag team. We'll put in a woman. We'll put in a person of color. We'll put in someone who's dead, and that's how they fill out. And then at the end, they say, "Oh, in our legacy wing, here's." Luthez.
Jushin Thunder Liger.
Yeah. And or here's Hiro Matsuda in our legacy wing. And like all these guys are the ones that created here's Danny Hodge in our legacy wing. Danny Hodge is maybe the greatest American wrestler in the history of organized sports, but he's in your legacy wing as an afterthought after you put in Coco Beware or you put in some other clown that couldn't lace Danny Hodges' boots. But, yeah, and so Gary Hart, yes, going in is deserved, and I don't know why I'm getting excited over a company that he never wrestled for. But was there another name that you pointed out? Because I noticed one.
You pointed I'm going to have to go look it up, but Jushin Thunder Liger also got in. Out of nowhere, it was like, wait, what did I miss? Why is Jushin Thunder Liger there?
Yeah.
And
another in the legacy wing, along with Gary Hart and the person that Gary Hart managed, Buzz Sawyer, is now in the WWE Hall of Fame.
There's another name I need to look up. Hold on. Talk about those guys for a second.
Buzz Sawyer, probably. He was my Spud Webb Award winner, the greatest wrestler under 6 feet tall. I put him and Eddie Gilbert in the same category. Buzz Sawyer, listeners of the HIAC Talk Radio podcast, and I will die on this hill every time. Buzz Sawyer had the single greatest power slam in the history of professional wrestling, ever. Buzz Sawyer would catch anyone off the ropes, and he would go completely perpendicular to the mat and slam a person. Buzz Sawyer, single greatest power slam in the history of wrestling. Buzz Sawyer also was the first trainer of The Undertaker. That's right, yes. He told the story on the Stone Cold podcast. But yeah, pretty much just took the guy's money and beat the crap out of him and then then left town.
Brickhouse Brown.
What?
Brickhouse Brown went in.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Okay, I'll put him into the Coco Beware category.
That's why I was hoping you were going to talk about it. You didn't even know.
No, I didn't know. I barely know Brickhouse Brown existed when he wrestled. So, it goes back to my Ernie Ladd story. What put Brickhouse Brown on the map, Dan, was before he went to Memphis and made kind of a name for himself. He was being a rookie on Mid-Atlantic TV, and he get crushed. But he show a lot of heart, and the announcer would talk about how much heart he had. Then Rufus R. Jones, another black superstar of the 70s, then he said, "I'm going to get with Brickhouse, and I'm going to help him out." So in Brickhouse's match with Ernie Ladd, Rufus R. Jones interfered, and Brickhouse Brown got a pin on Ernie Ladd. So that put Brickhouse Brown on the map, and the After magazine ate it up. And, of course, after the match, Ernie attacked Rufus R. Jones, laid him out, took Ernie about 20 minutes to climb to the top rope, and he came off with a devastating flying body press. And Gary Hart came to the ring and counted 1, 2, 3 while Ernie put his foot on his chest. Ernie Ladd put over Brickhouse Brown to give him the biggest win of his career.
Dr. Death went in.
What the hell took it? Why is Dr. Why now? And you're going in the same class as Brickhouse Brown?
Here's one that'll piss you off.
Yes.
Greg Stevens.
You know, I was going to say
Just in there.
Because how many times have I said on this very podcast of people that aren't in the Hall of Fame but should be in there? And in 2021, Ray Stevens is in the WWE Hall of Fame in 2021. When you could have put him in there 35 years earlier.
I just let Dick the Bruiser went in.
Oh, goody.
Paul Bosch.
Oh, man.
Pistol Pez Watley. Ethel Johnson went in.
Okay, first black woman.
The tag team champion, NWA World's Women Tag Team Champion. Rob Van Dam went in.
We saw that.
Deserved.
Yeah.
Great Khali.
No.
Kane,
yeah.
For multiple reasons, yes.
Yeah.
GM Spectre, I'll read that message in a second. Bischoff went in for reasons that he should be in there. Mm-hmm. And Molly Holly, which we covered 2 weeks ago, absolutely, without question, no matter what your argument is, absolutely deserves to be in the Hall of Fame, and she's in there. Yeah. Baron Michelle Leon.
Yeah. From the biggest stars of the 50s.
Legacy.
Yeah.
The New World Order went in, which, fuck Hogan, whatever, but it was Hall, Nash, and Waltman. I'm like, Waltman, I get it. He's your friend. I mean, Waltman's a Hall of Famer, but.
Yeah, not for.
NWO? Like, no. Yeah.
Well, he's a Hall of Famer in two groups now. Did he go in with DX 2 years ago?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, he's X-Pac. He's in his sixth and X-Pac now.
Okay. So he's in the Hall of Fame for two different fringe groups.
He should be in for Waltman. I think he's a Hall of Fame wrestler. That's just my opinion.
As far as junior heavyweights go, yes. He's been with Lightning Kid and his 1-2-3 Kid, yes. His work ethic is.
As I said earlier, Jushin Thunder Liger of the British Bulldog.
Yeah.
John Bradshaw Layfield.
Interesting, the British Bulldog is in, but the Dynamite Kid is not.
Is it interesting?
Yeah.
Is it? Titus O'Neil got the Warrior Award, and I'll just say it should be renamed the Titus O'Neil Award. Whatever.
Yeah.
Did more. I'll say, so here's a fucking hot take, and it's not really a hot take, but it's a woke hot take, but I'm right, and the rest of you are wrong, to stand by it, and if anybody text messages you over it, just send them my way and I'll deal with it politely, but don't bother, you're wrong. Titus O'Neil has done more for his wrestling community and the community in general and is taken and given at a good pace versus the warrior who took and gave little back.
I agree. Some would argue that the warrior gave nothing back to the world of professional wrestling.
That is true. I was trying to be a little nice about it because he's dead and all, but...
Yeah, but like you said, with many dead people, Dan, he doesn't care. He can't hear. But
it's true. It's very true.
Warrior, if anything, left the business worse than when he entered it, which it cannot be said for Titus O'Neil.
Geo Spector just said true.
Yeah, who has made everything. Titus O'Neil, his presence in the WWE has only made it better.
And no, Warrior's presence was...
problematic. Okay. Warrior has a place in wrestling history. Yes.
Yes. On
taking
the
up, taking up, but taking up after Hogan are impossible shoes to fill. He did an admirable job as far as keeping business at that same level. They were still sellouts. He drew money for whatever reason, and as limited as he was, the man was incredibly over. So in that respect, he has a spot in wrestling history because I didn't think anyone could follow Hogan, but Warrior did because he fit the same mold as Hogan.
Now, a douchebag.
Yeah, which is apparently what you needed to be a WWF champion. Obviously, the bloom came off the rose very quickly, but for what Warrior did for that short amount of time can't be understated because the man was extremely over, and I was it got me a little bit. I mean,
yeah, I was just saying, you got all of us, man.
Yeah, you got all of us. But again, the bloom went off the road very quickly, and it when we find that we comes to light who the actual person behind the Warrior persona was, Jim Helwig is not deserving of any accolades or any Hall of Fame worthy achievements because his achievements were very few.
I will say this: watching those old shoot videos he does against Hogan.
Yeah.
Entertaining as hell. Okay. Just puts Hogan, I mean, the scum covering the scum, a pond, but I know you, Terry. I'm just like, yeah. Bella Twins. Yes, but they opened up wrestling to a whole group of little girls. Like, it's not, who am I to crap on it? Certainly added more to wrestling than the... Never mind, I won't finish that sentence. I remember, yes, Spector said, I remember the NWA 1989 stable of Sullivan's Slaughterhouse, Sullivan, Buzz Soil, and a rookie Cactus Jack Manson.
Yep.
Oh, man. Yeah, better, you know, respect to the Bell Twins, but moving on.
Yeah. And just to all the HIAC Talk Radio listeners of this podcast, are you here to... We talk about wrestling, and I do a segment called Wrestling Historian.
Coming up next.
That's coming up next, so stay tuned. But the names Dick the Bruiser, Ray Stevens, Baron Michelle Leone.
How dare you put them in the legacy wing and not do a feature on them?
And Paul Bosch, those names alone deserve to be...
Their whenever, own class.
Yes. Whenever there was a Hall of Fame... even discussed in professional wrestling. It's like, you know what? We ought to do a Hall of Fame for professional wrestling. Those names should have been first.
Without Paul Bosch, Texas wrestling doesn't
exist.
Start.
Yes. And you wouldn't have the careers of most of the wrestlers that we talk about here if it weren't for Paul Bosch giving them their big break. It goes back to Ernie Ladd. Was huge in Texas.
The catalyst of HIAC. Oh, if only he was alive, I'd be able to reach out and go, hey!
But Ernie was born in Texas. He played for the Houston Oilers. He headlined the Sam Houston Coliseum more than any other wrestler during that era. And, again, the Von Erichs, Gino, the Freebirds, Junkyard Dog, Fritz, yeah, the Midnight Express, Magnum T.A.
Gary Hart,
all Paul Bosch, all of them, if it weren't for them. And I know there's tons of people that I'm missing, and the person that reminded me about Peter Maivia is probably going to remind me again.
Good. Please do.
Please do.
You put Craig in his place when you need to.
Exactly. But Paul Bosch, just like with Dick the Bruiser or Ray Stevens and Baron Michelle Leone, Baron Michelle Leone was and with Gorgeous George, the most watched professional wrestler of the 50s. When wrestling was on network TV, Baron Michele Leone was, next to Gorgeous George, the single most popular wrestler there. On an average, what we would do it now would be 38 million people a week would be watching wrestling on network television back then. This man was a star, was a superstar, with
larger than life.
With Cary Grant, Gary Cooper stars, where he would appear with them on red carpets at movie premieres. That's how big Baron Michele Leone was. Okay.
And in those days, it didn't happen. It's not like The Rock and John Cena walking into a Hollywood premiere and 5 years later to become actors. This was wrestling was a sport. It was real, and these people were hanging out with Hollywood stars. That's the thing. That's a bigger deal.
Baron Michele Leone, Gorgeous George, Fred Blassie during the 60s, they were on television every week on network television. They were movie stars. They were TV stars. They were television stars. And when they went on the road to wrestle, they would sell out. Baron Michele Leone and Luthez did about 58 share on a TV show. But they did about, there were 28,000 at the Chicago Stadium because of the popularity of Baron Michele Leone on television. Ray Stevens was probably I don't know where to start with him. The turnbuckle flop that Ric Flair had made famous, where do you think he learned it from?
Ray?
Ray Stevens maybe single-handedly put West Coast wrestling on the map to the point where Bruno Sammartino went out to San Francisco because Ray Stevens was drawing sold-out numbers because they wanted to get those two together. Ray Stevens was the United States champion in San Francisco. He beat Bruno by a countout, and he started calling himself the WWF heavyweight champion, and that drew him not even more sellout crowds, but drew him heat because there was no internet back then. So it got back to the East Coast that Ray Stevens is calling himself the WWF champion. Wait a minute, Vince McMahon had to call Roy Shire and said, "Is your guy doing that?" He goes, "Yeah, okay, well tell him to stop because I can't have Bruno fly back out there for it." Don't do that, but that's how over Ray Stevens was.
Yeah.
Part of two of maybe the two greatest tag teams in the history of the AWA.
That's the thing I always forget. He didn't do it once. He did it twice.
With Pat Patterson and with Nick Bockwinkel.
Yeah.
And Patterson and Stevens were the tag team that every other tag team wanted to be. In two different interviews with Dusty Rhodes and Dick Murdoch when they were the Texas Outlaws. What team were you trying to be like? Well, we were trying to be like Patterson and Stevens. When they asked Michael Hayes, when you and Terry Gordy started out, who'd you want to be? Well, we dyed our hair blonde because we wanted to be like Patterson and Stevens. They set the bar.
Legacy wing.
Yeah, but no, we'll put them in a legacy wing. And we'll overlook the fact that both the AWA and the NWA wanted to make Ray Stevens their world champion because of how good he was and because of what a great worker he was. And even in his 40s, late 40s, he was one half of the NWA Tag Team Champions with Greg Valentine, with Jimmy Snuka, with Ivan Koloff. Came all the way here to the WWF to put Jimmy Snuka over when Jimmy Snuka turned face for the first time. Who did he do it against? Ray Stevens. When Ray was 49 years old and on half a knee and could still bump his ass off. Ray Stevens is the type of wrestler that you not only try to be, but you will always fail because you can never be as good as Ray Stevens. But Ray Stevens is the type of wrestler that if you want to become a professional wrestler, don't look at what he does in the ring. Look how he does outside of the ring. The interaction with the crowd. Not just the flips on the arm drag takeovers, or not just the flying into the back and forth across the rope, not how he takes a drop kick, how he takes a backdrop, how he gets flung into the turnbuckle before the flips, going into the back and just selling. Ray Stevens is the blueprint for how to sell. to how to being a heel. Not only does this man deserve his own wing of Hall of Fame, he deserves his own school.
Yeah, it's good. The little building, the side building on the main campus, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, while you're on a roll, dude, why don't you just take over the Wrestling Historian?
I feel like I've already done it, but I got another wind in me. I'll call it my second wind. And that got Amber up, so we're going to start it right away. Hold on.
Right away, yeah. Oh, called him on the spot. My fault.
No, that's okay. I understand.
Keep Amber waiting. Go ahead. Go.
Gentlemen and ladies, welcome back to this edition of HIAC Talk Radio. Please don't mind the suit, yes?
I just want to read to you J-Rod's comment where he just says, I'm just here for the cat.
And that's why I'm here too, J-Rod.
J-Rod.
The only reason I'm here.
Sorry, dude. Start over.
That's okay.
The cat is intrigued by the conversation. Yeah, I'm trying to see if Amber is looking at me and hates me, or is just, you were the one that was playing with me with that watch. I'm going to get you.
Is that the motherfucker with the watch?
Yeah, that motherfucker's not allowed to come here anymore. Good. Start over. Sorry.
Start the camera. Welcome back, HIAC Talk Radio Special Edition. Folks, don't mind the suit. I'm just trying to be Hall of Fame worthy. We just discussed that in our last episode of HIAC Talk Radio. But this episode of HIAC Talk Radio, we're going to stay in the past and talk about some of the great stuff that happened back when professional wrestling was indeed professional wrestling and not sports entertainment. And we're going to focus on a particular week because if you saw anything on the WWE Hall of Fame ceremony, you'll know that we are in WrestleMania week. So this, gentlemen and ladies, and this edition of Wrestling Historian, we're going to be focusing on WrestleMania week and some dates that changed professional wrestling altogether. We're going to start, I mentioned this in our previous HIAC Talk Radio broadcast about a Clash of Champions. April 2nd, 1989 was not only was it the same day as WrestleMania 5, which was skipped because it was held at a place that had been destroyed, that was owned by a former president, but what also happened on that day was April 2nd, 1989, was Clash of Champions 6. Yes, go ahead.
I just want to point out that they, just to take the stigma off the building, Boardwalk Hall is not, has never been, and will never be owned by Donald Trump. It's next to Trump Plaza, or whatever the hell it's called now. I think that's gone now.
Yeah.
I think they actually tore it down recently. They just said that because from Trump Plaza because of the endorsement from Donald Trump. Boardwalk Hall is a separate arena. It's got nothing to do with him. Sorry, I just wanted to hit you off before any of your friends texted you and corrected you.
It's okay. Well, that's why I don't have any friends.
Clash Champions. Sorry.
Clash Champions. That's all I'll focus on. Because WrestleMania 5, and I saw them both on the same day back when you could. I went to WrestleMania 5 during the afternoon. I saw it on closed circuit TV at the Philadelphia Spectrum, the beautiful air-conditioned Philadelphia Spectrum. Then came home and watched Clash of Champions, the real wrestling. That Clash of Champions 6. Not only did I see the Varsity Club defeat the Road Warriors for the NWA Tag Team Championship, making Mike Rotunda the only person to ever defeat the Road Warriors for a World Championship twice.
As it should be.
As it should be. Not only was it the debut of the Great Muta, managed by Gary Hart, but it was also the epic 1 hour, 2 out of 3 falls match between Ric Flair and Ricky Steamboat. Match that went 55 minutes total, but it would be an hour. And I come back to this every year. After the match, they went full 2 out of 3 falls, 1 hour. They interviewed Ricky Steamboat, who was the NWA champion at the time, and they interviewed him, and he wasn't even breathing hard. He was talking to Jim Ross just like he talked to him before.
I can't relate.
No. But yeah, that's the most fascinating thing about that day, April 2nd, 1989.
Can you just wrestle for an hour? No, what?
Yeah.
Because Dan, you okay? Yeah, I went to the refrigerator a second ago.
Yeah, but this was now, and this, also the more remarkable thing, this was 10 years after Flair and Steamboat first started their feud. Their feud started in 1977, and their matches, when they were going an hour every day for a solid month over the NWA and United States Heavyweight Championship or the Mid-Atlantic TV title, that was Steamboat's first title. That was also Ric Flair's first title. So it's 12 years later, and they're still going an hour. And neither one of them are breathing heavy.
That's insane. That's insane.
But the one person I have to thank for that, Dan, a person we talked about on last week's...
It's this week's.
Is this, or that we talked about in the last episode of HIC Talk Radio. They are both trained by the great Vern Gagne.
Who is not a racist.
Didn't say that. But
never said it, but you just had to be told.
Yes,
we're kidding. By the way, it's funny.
Yeah,
so just don't. We're not being serious because apparently every time we are on here, it's serious.
But with wrestlers that I've disparaged on this very podcast, I can still
fuck them. Every one of them.
I can still say good things about. It was Undertaker's birthday, our last show, and I said plenty of good things to say about him, even though I've never been a fan of his at all.
Yeah, fuck him too.
Vern Gagne, his school of wrestling, as archaic as his manners of his training may be, they produced two of the greatest wrestlers of all time, to the point where both of those men, Ric Flair and Ricky Steamboat, are two of the finest physical specimens of cardiovascular genetics that I've ever seen or ever encountered. And that was all due to Vern Gagne's training. Again, the training methods may have been archaic. If you've heard any or if you've seen the Ric Flair 30 for 30 documentary where he details their training, running up flights of stairs, 30 flight, and then carrying someone up those same flights of stairs, up and down the stairs, and the 500 squats, and the 500 thrusts, and the 500 pull-ups, and the 500 sit-ups, and he burned this into each of their minds, their brains, their repetition of exercising to the point where when they were on the road, especially Flair, when he could, in towns where he couldn't find a gym, he would do those same things in his hotel room. 500 squats, 500 sit-ups, 500 pull-ups, 500 push-ups. And Steamboat did the same thing. You know, we talked about the NWA champion, about how the rigors involved, or even just the schedule, which is insane. With someone like Ernie Ladd, who was a main event everywhere he could, and why he couldn't have been an NWA champion. And it wasn't there was a concerted effort not to make Ernie Ladd a champion, but the schedule would have killed him because Ernie Ladd couldn't wrestle an hour every night, seven nights a week, every week for 2 years straight. It would have killed him physically. And as far as the people that could physically do it, Flair could, Dory Funk Jr. could, Harley could, and if you wanted to, Ricky Steamboat could. Because he was more than physically capable of wrestling an hour every night in a different town every week for a number of years. But what Flair and Steamboat did in 89, 12 years after they first started doing hour matches, stuck out to me. So April 2nd, 1989. Also, that WrestleMania week... WrestleMania 22 in Chicago, 2006, April 2nd, 2006. The biggest thing that stuck out to me was the entrance of John Cena coming out in the old Untouchables car.
Ah, yes.
With the Tommy guns.
Wonder why.
Yeah, and one of the people that was there making his WrestleMania debut, unbeknownst to us, CM Punk.
Happened years earlier with a car and a pink Cadillac at WrestleMania
6.
And DDP's pink Cadillac.
Right, driving rhythm.
Great, technically made his debut in wrestling at WrestleMania.
There it was. And all because he's the only one that he owned a pink Cadillac. And
bro, I got a pink Cadillac, bro. Bro.
Happy belated April 3rd. Happy belated birthday to Lance Storm. Happy 52nd birthday, April 3rd, to Lance Storm. April 4th, 1993, WrestleMania 9, the first outdoor WrestleMania. And some would say the worst, WrestleMania 9 in Las Vegas.
Some would agree.
Yeah, but featured the debut of many people making their first WrestleManias on that particular WrestleMania. Razor Ramon, Lex Luger, the Steiners, and Jim Ross all made their first WrestleManias on that date, April 4th, 1993. April 5th, this is probably one of the biggest dates in professional wrestling history, only because of what it meant to professional wrestling, how it still resonates today. You know, we're talking about celebrities, you know, that have appeared at WrestleManias over the years. But April 5th, 1982, at the Memphis Mid-South Coliseum, only 8,019 people showed up on a Monday night.
You're fired.
On a Monday night, to see Jerry Lawler take on the challenge of Andy Kaufman.
There's only 8,000 people there.
Seemed a lot more.
Oh my, it sounded like a lot more.
Yeah. And it was one of those things, Dave, was like Will Chamberlain, because the match was so big, and now everyone claims that they were there. Now at least 20,000 people say, yeah, I was there, I saw it. When Andy Kaufman took on Jerry Lawler for the Intergender Heavyweight Wrestling Championship. Up till then, before that, Andy Kaufman had been baiting Jerry Lawler with his now legendary video sketches, putting down the great people of Memphis, Tennessee.
You're from Hollywood. I mean, you're from Memphis. I am from Hollywood.
That how you talk, Mr. Lawler?
I like telling the story, Craig, about Kaufman and Lawler, because, you know, I always tell this story like this because my dad, who shit on wrestling for years, and rightfully so, even though he watched roller derby. Mm-hmm. Another story for another time. But he would every day he would watch me watching wrestling at any age would be like the first time he saw me watching it. Mm-hmm. And he'd have to say the same lines always. This is stupid. This is, I can't repeat. But, and last year we were having it was in October when I saw them last during pandemic times. Mm-hmm. We were having a conversation, and I threw out the term kayfabe. Oh. And he's like, what are you talking about? And I explained to him, the way I was explaining it, because I'm not on planet Earth with the rest of us, I go, Dad, do you remember, because I know he talked about this when I was younger. He's like, I wonder when Lawler and, when Jerry the King Lawler or whatever and Andy Kaufman fought, that's when I watched wrestling. And I brought up, hey, remember Lawler and Andy Kaufman? Yeah, he almost broke his neck. Yeah, that wasn't real, Dad. And he just went, camera on me. He just went, I said, yeah, that was part of the show, Dad. He didn't break his neck. He didn't pile drive him twice and almost kill him. It's part of a gimmick. And I blew his mind. And he kind of, I saw it that moment at 65 years of age that he was like, oh, got it.
Gotcha.
But that's how big that was. Like, yeah, I never watched wrestling. Too. It was like,
yeah. But he,
I remember Lawler and Kaufman. They didn't even remember Jerry Lawler's name.
Yeah. The fact that he thought it was, he dismissed it so much, but Andy Kaufman made him remember Jerry Lawler.
Just remember it. Have you ever seen My Breakfast with Blassie? I've never seen that.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm from Hollywood. That documentary that was made in the early 90s? Because Robin Williams was on it.
Right, and most of the cast of Taxi was on it. Robin Williams and Tony Tucker, Tony Danza, and Mary Lou Henner. And
that got played on Comedy Central for like 10 years. All the time.
I own the VHS tape. I bought it at a Hollywood video.
But they kind of kayfabe it. They kind of they work
did.
Shoot the hell out of that.
Yes, because they all kept saying the same thing. You just never knew with Andy. You didn't know if he was serious, and you didn't know how far he was going to take this. And you know, and they couldn't show. Obviously, they couldn't show the Letterman stuff. They couldn't show on Saturday Night Live. They showed the newspaper clippings from the actual New York Times when he was and when it happened, because April 5th, 1982. That Monday night, it made national news. I mean, and to the point where it was on the news here in Philadelphia, that what had happened to Andy Kaufman, because Andy Kaufman wasn't, as much as he says, I'm a star, Andy Kaufman was like the fifth cast member in Taxi, which was a top five show. And a top five show in 1982 on network TV could get you anywhere between 30 and 35 million viewers a week. A week, not just a one episode, you get 35 million. It's every week they got between 30 and 35 million viewers on ABC to watch Taxi. And like I said, Andy Kaufman wasn't even a star of that show. He was maybe like the fourth or fifth guy down, but still, everyone knew Andy Kaufman was. So when he gets pile-drived in Tennessee by this wrestler, it was huge everywhere.
This motherfucker.
Yeah. This guy, how dare he? And they even mentioned it on Saturday Night Live on Weekend Update that weekend, because Andy had been such a big part of Saturday Night Live up till then. Andy Kaufman was on the very first episode of Saturday Night Live, October 9th, 1975. So he and Saturday Night Live go back a long way. So that was a big deal, made national news. And the thing is, that night, he and Jerry talked about how they were going to do it, and got the fans so into it and so upset because Andy kept running away and baiting Jerry with his, you know, meow, 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 meow. And finally Jerry Lawler walked out, grabbed the microphone, and said, let me ask you something. You come here to wrestle, act like an ass. And the place went nuts. And they played this whole clip on network news shows, and they had to bleep the word ass, because that's
no.
Yeah, 1982. And he said, now look, I know you must know one wrestling hold. I'll get in the ring, I'll let you put me in a headlock, and I won't do anything. So he goes in the ring, and Lawler puts his hands behind his back, and Andy puts him in a headlock. And I still don't know what was said. Andy Kaufman was saying something to Jerry, and Jerry put up his finger and just started telling the crowd, just wait 1 second. Picked him up in a belly-to-back suplex. And I thought that broke his neck. It wasn't the pile drivers. I thought the belly-to-back suplex.
It looked so devastating. It was just this little guy.
Andy landed so wrong, and his chin hit his chest, and I know that legitimately knocked him out. And it gets better, Amber. Calm down. And then when Jerry picked him up for not one but two pile drivers, and the pile driver was so devastating, folks, back in 1982, that it was illegal in Tennessee and in many arenas in the South. So if you pile drive your opponent, you were instantly disqualified. So when Jerry Lawler pile drive Andy Kaufman, Jerry Lawler was disqualified. So the winner of that match was Andy Kaufman. So after the referee called for the bell, and Jerry gave him another one, and Andy was laid out, stretched out, and fans were going crazy. And Andy didn't move, and Jerry didn't move, and Bob Zamuda was in the ring, and the referee, Jerry Calhoun, didn't know what to do. He was the liaison between the two, and he bent down and said, Andy, you're all right? And he goes, yeah, I'm fine. Of course he's fine. Jerry goes back to Jerry Calhoun. The referee goes back to Jerry Lawler. He said, yeah, he's fine. He said, well, tell him to get up. Calhoun goes back to Andy. Andy, Jerry wants to make. Wants you to get up. He goes, no, I want an ambulance. Andy says, Jerry Calhoun gets up, walks over to Jerry Lawler and says, Jerry, Andy wants an ambulance. Jerry's like, ambulance? That's $500. I'm not paying for that. Jerry Calhoun goes back to Andy Kaufman. He nods his head, goes back to Jerry Lawler. Andy says he'll pay for it. Jerry goes, all right, get him an ambulance.
Get him an ambulance, whatever.
They backed the ambulance into the Mid-South Coliseum.
This took like 20 minutes, guys.
Yes, it took forever. But no one went anywhere, and the cameras were still rolling.
Is he dead?
And there were matches that went on afterwards. This wasn't, you know.
Yeah, this is like mid-show, maybe. Yeah. Maybe beginning, but this was like early on. Yeah, Andy was probably telling him, hey, suplex me as hard as you can.
Let me take it. And they backed an ambulance into the Mid-South Coliseum, and they loaded Andy neck brace, loaded it onto a backboard, and into a stretcher, and carted him into the ambulance. And again, this was national news. This was a major TV star of a network show that was cut off in the hospital, and he spent 3 days in the hospital. TV networks were there to interview him, and he said, I always thought wrestling was fake, but apparently this one wasn't. And he made the rounds for the next 4 months wearing a neck brace.
We'll talk about part two to that story another day.
When are we on the Letterman? But Andy Kaufman frequented the Madison Square Garden shows in the WWF when it came every Monday night. That's where he got to meet Fred Blassie, another one of his heroes that he grew up watching on network TV, along with Baron Leone and Buddy Rogers and Gorgeous George. But Vince Sr. didn't want anything to do with him. Vince Sr. said in his words, wrestlers and celebrities don't mix. I don't want celebrities in the ring with my wrestlers.
Oopsies.
Yeah. 3 years later, WrestleMania 1, Hulk Hogan and Mr. T.
Speaking of not adapting.
Yeah. But Bill Apter, who was a friend of Andy Kaufman and Jerry Lawler, said had Jerry Lawler said no, Andy Kaufman's next stop would have been Florida and Dusty Rhodes.
Oh, Dusty would have done it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But, April 5th, 1982, big day professional wrestler. And if we're talking about the WWE Hall of Fame and how they have a legacy wing and they also have a celebrity wing, why isn't Andy Kaufman in there?
That's a very good question. Even with the Lawler, so wait, Shatner got in there before?
Yeah. And I kind of knew he wasn't going to go in when they could have done it when the movie came out.
Okay. Sure.
But no.
That doesn't make any sense. No, that's if I bet you that's on YouTube. I'm going to look that up on YouTube. But the I'm from Hollywood. It's a work. It's wonderfully produced, wonderfully done. And he always dreamed of wrestling. I remember it.
Yeah, I'm from Hollywood, and they showed tapes that I hadn't seen before, like an Andy beating up that very large woman. I'd never.
Oh
seen
yeah,
that
yeah.
Before.
That's the thing. The build up, just real quick. The build up was this was intergender before intergender was like we want more intergender matches. Andy, this is how it's like Andy knew what he was doing.
Yeah.
He'd go on Saturday Night Live or another talk show or any other show that would have him and do this whole thing where men are superior to women and I can out wrestle any woman in the world and I'll take it. And then he'd have her beat him.
Yeah.
Or he'd have to cheat to win or steal something. But he total heel.
Yeah,
the entire time, and he got it, and he always looked like the fool, which is something that is sorely missing these days. Not to sound like an old fogey, but
it's you can watch Andy Kaufman, and he always wanted to say, in his words, I always wanted to be a bad guy wrestler, but you see how easy it is to get heat because whenever he appeared on, and he was on Merv Griffin and on Mike Douglas and even on Saturday Night Live with Buddy Rogers as his manager when he wrestled a woman on live TV, getting heat when the woman's back was turned or when she was on the ground, Andy would kick her or nudge her with his foot, and the crowd would go nuts. Are you kidding? And just, they wanted to kill him. And when he made up these tapes about Memphis wrestling and holding up toilet paper, this is called toilet paper. And this is pronounced soap, not soap, but soap. And you use it to get it wet and you put it on your body. And he would send these clips in to Memphis TV and they would play them and Lance Russell would play them. And oh, come on, Andy, that's too much. When he went to Uranus, they wanted to kill him. They wanted to boil him in oil and sell his fat for soap. That's how you get it. It's so easy. And I don't know why people don't understand how easy that is to get heat. But that was April 5th.
I digest.
But I digest. April 6th, two big things happened on this date, a year apart. We were talking about how Hall of Fame. And I mentioned the people that you mentioned that just got in the legacy when this year, in 2021, names like Dick the Bruiser and Ray Stevens, which is absolutely ludicrous and ridiculous. But in 2013, the WWE Hall of Fame inducted the two longest reigning champions in WWF history. They're 1 and 2. Bruno Sammartino and Bob Backlund went into the WWF Hall of Fame in 2013. And Gray, it was in the Madison Square Garden in New York for WrestleMania 29 that year. But why would the two biggest, the two longest reigning champions in WWE history, one held it for 8 years straight, one held it for 5 years and 10 months, they just went in.
Well, the Bruno thing was because Bruno was like, fuck WWF for a long time.
Yeah. And Bob wasn't too complimentary of them either. But the fact that they both went in, and it was also probably Dan Rouse, probably the last Hall of Fame ceremony I saw, because it also was one of the most entertaining. Not only did Bruno and Backlund go in way overdue, but Cactus Jack, Mick Foley went in that year too. And even just his off the mark, his offhand comment, all things he didn't get to do, I never beat Chris Jericho. It just out of the blue. And then Chris Jericho runs on stage and tells Mick, I'll take an elbow. And then CM Punk runs on stage to be the referee. And first he's walking towards Chris real slow, and Chris is lying down, and Mick goes, no, no, no. And then out of nowhere, he drops the elbow on Jericho. Punk counts to three, and then immediately gives the X sign to signal everyone that Chris Jericho is really hurt. And then Mick continues his speech, but that was one of the most – that was probably the most entertaining Hall of Fame that I remember, that Bob Backlund, Bruno Sammartino, and Mick Foley all went to in the Hall of Fame that same year, way overdue. Richly deserved by Mick Foley, but Backlund and Sammartino deserved a lot better. That same day, a year later, to the April 6, 2014, the WrestleMania 30, the streak ends. Landmark day in professional wrestling history.
That should have ended it.
Yeah.
It was perfect. And I understand the want to go on and the need to go on. And
I don't.
I understand it from the performer's perspective, sure. But my perspective, that was a perfect out.
Yeah. Yeah. Undertaker has mentioned this many times. We still don't know if you... I say go back and watch it on the Peacock, but forget it.
No, that you can find.
Okay. But during the match, and he still doesn't know when, but the Undertaker sustained a concussion early in that match with Brock, and he, like you said, he doesn't remember when it happened. But for everyone who said it was a shoot.
Hence the concussion.
Yeah. That he was supposed to kick out, and he didn't. That was it. He found out that the streak was ending when he got there. And but at WrestleMania 30, April 6, 2014, the streak ends, and with good reason.
It's just, you talk about moments that don't happen anymore, and I know it was, that's one in the modern times where it's like, mm-hmm. perfectly executed.
Yes.
Perfectly. To the referee's reaction, to the people's real reaction at ringside.
Yeah, they still have, there's still memes of that guy.
Yeah. The Paulie's reaction.
Yeah.
It was perfect. Perfectly yeah. done.
Mm-hmm. End of the streak.
Well, thank God he went out on a bonehouse match or something.
Thank God he went out on during an episode of Walking Dead, the way that every good wrestler should end their career. On a Hollywood soundstage with tons of extras and multiple takes. Yes, that's professional wrestling. Which brings us to today, wrestling history. Show you how far we've come. It is WrestleMania season, folks, but I want to bring out April today on this date, 1986. 35 years ago today was WrestleMania II. The second WrestleMania. This is and it's the only WrestleMania that actually had a number, not a Roman numeral. It was actually the number 2. And just like that poster behind Dan.
Yes, right there, yes.
Yes. But this WrestleMania, let me show you how far we've come and how much it was. WrestleMania, after the success of the first WrestleMania, we mentioned Mr. T, huge house in Madison Square Garden. Video sales from Coliseum Videos broke records, and it was a big deal. So they wanted WrestleMania 2. They wanted to make it even bigger and better. So they had the great idea, I say great in huge sarcastic terms, to have WrestleMania 2 in 3 different locations, at the Nassau Coliseum, in the UIC Pavilion in Chicago, and the Los Angeles Sports Arena in L.A. Massive, massive logistical nightmare for all 3 of those venues, and this was available on closed-circuit TV. Again, I went to the beautiful air-conditioned Spectrum to watch this. And all 3 of them, they started in Nassau, Long Island, Uniondale, at the Nassau Coliseum, and then it went to Chicago, and then they went to L.A., because the main event was Hulk Hogan versus King Kong Bundy, and they just packed it with all sorts of gimmickry and celebrities. In Los Angeles, they had the ring announcer for Hogan and King Kong Bundy was Robert Conrad and Ricky Schroeder. And to see Schroeder next to Bundy and to have everyone in Philadelphia yelling, "Splash Schroeder! Splash Conrad!"
What did they ever do?
They were celebrities. And that was just in L.A., Dan. In Chicago, for the Invitational Battle Royal, they had a whole bunch of football players.
William Perry.
Bill Frelick, Russ Francis. William Refrigerator Perry, yeah, that was also where the WWF Tag Team title changed hands, where the British Bulldogs defeated Greg Valentine and Brutus Beefcake, and the British Bulldogs in their corner was not only Lou Albano, but Ozzy Osbourne,
yep.
Who went into the celebrity wing of the WWE Hall of Fame this week. So there's another celebrity within one WrestleMania, but yet he's in the he was on Raw. They won the Osbourne.
I was
going to
say it was the general manager, guest general manager at one point.
Yeah, every week. Yeah, so yeah. But again, Ozzy Osbourne's in a celebrity wing. But
let's go crazy.
But Andy Kaufman is not.
Who did Andy piss off?
Yeah, but neither Cyndi Lauper, which is another outrageous, egregious. If not for Cyndi Lauper, there wouldn't be a
round. No, that's just stupid.
If you really want to get into it.
That's just really dumb now.
Yeah. Also during the Invitational Battle Royal that Andre the Giant won, that was Bruno's. Bruno was also in that Battle Royal. That was his last WrestleMania. And the last person that was eliminated was Bret Hart. It was the Hart Foundation and Andre were the only ones left, and Andre eliminated Jim Neidhart and then Bret Hart. And that was the Hart Foundation's WrestleMania debut.
Yeah.
And 3 WrestleManias later at the other Battle Royal that was won by Bad News Brown, Bret Hart was again the last man eliminated. So Bret Hart was eliminated from the last man eliminated for the first 2 Battle Royals in WrestleMania history.
Good.
But the big deal, in the Nassau Coliseum in Uniondale, Long Island, where the main event was Mr. T versus Roddy Piper in a boxing match. Check out the celebrities they had just for, I don't know how they got all these people into Uniondale, but Susan St. James did commentary.
The worst ever.
because she was married to Dick Ebersol, who is a...
That's wonderful for Dick Ebersol.
But Dick Ebersol was the one who put WWF on Creative Saturday Night's main event.
Really happy for you.
So
no.
give my wife a spot. And she did commentary on the Jake the Snake Roberts-George Wells match. Okay.
I would have rather heard Elvira do commentary on that.
And she was in Los Angeles.
I know. I'd rather have her on color commentating.
One of the cornermen for Mr. T in his boxing match with Roddy Piper was Joe Frazier, was one of his cornermen. Ray Charles did America the Beautiful, stirring rendition. Joan Rivers was a ring announcer for Randy Savage, George Steele Intercontinental title match. But the judges for the Roddy Piper, Mr. T boxing match, the now late great G. Gordon Liddy.
Man, great's a word for it.
Terrell Dawkins.
That's okay.
And Cab Calloway.
Absolutely fine. I have nothing. We could debate G. Gordon Liddy, but I'll have nothing to say about Dawkins and Cab Calloway because
what,
goddamn
Cab
Calloway. If you
need judges for a boxing match.
Cab Calloway is yeah.
And Terrell Dawkins.
Absolutely. Cab Calloway, the boxing great that he was before he became a singer in Baltimore.
But that was just an indicator.
He was a low-down hoochie-coochie.
Mom took me to see that movie when I was 13 years old.
You know what I appreciate about Cab Calloway?
What?
Is every decade he would re-release that song in a different style and it would be a chart-topper.
Yeah.
That motherfucker got it. He's like, disco! Let's do it.
He went to the Chubby Checker School of well going. I've got one move to the hoop. I've got one well.
I'm gonna milk it until I'm dead. And he literally milked it till he was dead. And all respect and praise to the late great Cab Calloway, because that's awesome. I only discovered the disco version like 3 months ago. I was like, okay.
But one of the judges for the fight between Mr. T and Roddy Piper in WrestleMania 2, one of the three, yeah. But you can see how they went overboard trying to get as many celebrities as they could.
And they bring that back in for three, like one place.
Yeah, just one, yeah. We'll have it one place. We'll have Bob Uecker, we'll have Mary Hart, we'll have Aretha Franklin, and that's it.
And we're moving on.
Yeah.
Two out of three for that ain't bad.
But yeah, 35 years ago today, that took place, the second WrestleMania ever. And that, gentlemen and ladies, and Amber, is the Wrestling Historian. And you can follow me on Facebook, Instagram, and on Twitter. And if you can, and if you are more than welcome to correct me.
Please do, yeah. Him, not me.
To me. Point out anything I might have overlooked or might have forgotten at any of those social media platforms, like I said, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, at Craig Lagon, CraigLagons.
Sheldon's mama said, "Hi, Amber." Jan Spector says, "Always an awesome lesson from Craig." Hey, what music video is Cab Calloway in? In the 80s. It's not Janet. It's not Janet Jackson. Is it?
No, yes, it was.
Where
all
he
right.
just appears at the end.
Yeah, but it was Cab Calloway and the Nicholas Brothers. And it was, and the whole video was a vibe of the 40s.
Yeah, it was. They were wearing everything. They were wearing Cab Calloway jackets.
Yeah.
And then at the end, he's sleeping on the bench and he just walks by. Cab Calloway's the fuck up. frame, and it's like, and that was right before. I think that was right before he died.
That was the last. That was the last thing he did. Yeah.
One of my girlfriend's favorite videos.
Nice. 1986.
Unicorn King, what's going on? Right at the end, unfortunately, you're coming in, but Unicorn Key says hi, everyone. Or is it Kai? I think I'm pronouncing that wrong. You'd think I'd know seeing you in all the other rooms, and then when it comes time to get called on the carpet, I'm like, Kai.
Unicorn Kai.
I got it right the second time. I'm good.
Yes.
Thank you for coming in. I'm honored that you came into the room. Unfortunately, like I said, it is towards the end. It's all good. Glad I at least caught you on for a minute. I really appreciate you coming in. Thank you.
Thank you.
If wrestling's your thing, we'll be here next Wednesday. We'll be here every Wednesday. Because every time I get ready to say I'm not going to do it every Wednesday, I'm like, eh. where were we? Outro. That's right. Follow me on Twitter. We're not shutting down just yet. We're doing outros and then hang for a little while. But follow me on Twitter. Dan Lloyd. All social media platforms, actually. YouTube.com if you're watching this live. And if you're not watching this live, go to twitch.tv/DanLloyd3 and watch this live. VOCNation.com is the main hub of the podcast, the audio versions. Do it there every week for Craig Magan. There. No, look the other way. Look there. Good night, everybody.
This is Lance Storm, and if I can be serious for a minute, you're listening to VOC Nation Worldwide.
VOC Nation is one of the longest-running wrestling podcast networks. Having started way back in 2010, VOC Nation provides daily streaming shows where fans have the ability to interact with their hosts and guests via phone calls, emails, and Twitter. VOC Nation hosts also include former backstage interviewer from both AWA and WWE, Ken Resnick, former WCW performer The Maestro, former Impact performer Wes Crisco, Pro Wrestling Illustrated contributor Brady Hicks, and former Philadelphia radio personality Bruce Wirt. VOC Nation's two most popular shows are Wrestling with History, featuring Ken Resnick and Bruce Wirt, streaming live on Wednesday nights at 9:30 p.m. Eastern, and In the Room, featuring Pro Wrestling Illustrated Brady Hicks and WCW alum The Maestro. Both shows take callers live during the show, and recent guests have included General Adnan, Tito Santana, Haku, Earl Hebner, Danger Sandy Davis, Jimmy Hart, Ricky Steamboat, Brodus Clay, and so many more. Archive-free content includes past interviews with huge names like Hulk Hogan, Jesse Ventura, Kurt Angle, Sting, Mick Foley, Joey Styles, Howard Finkel, and so many more. Listen live at VOCNation.com and subscribe to all the podcasts by searching VOC Nation Radio Network on your favorite podcast app. And be sure to follow these guys on Twitter, at VOC Nation.
Hola, this is your amiga, Shelly from Cali, to let you know you can catch me here on VOC Nation for Shelly Live. You never know what the hell I'm going to be talking about. Sometimes I have guests. Sometimes I let you on in the cheese mess, spill a little tea. Sometimes I cry. You have to tune in to find out why. And I also take your calls. I love chatting with you guys and seeing what the hell you guys are thinking. So meet me here on the VOC Nation. Be there or be square.
Rock and Roll Union for the past 2 years has been the place for rock and roll, new rock and roll, debuting rock and roll, and some of the old classics as well. We have welcomed guests from around the world, national artists and more. We have excited many people by our live events. We've welcomed everybody into the fold, and we continue to do so on a weekly basis. Guys, that is Rock and Roll Union, and that is what we do for you.
Saturdays, 6 p.m. Eastern, VOCNation.com. Each and every Thursday night, check it out. WCW star Stro Maestro takes you on a journey. It's WCW Retro, talking old school match of the week, talking dream matches, taking your calls and looking back on an incredible career of acting, entertaining, and wrestling. Check it out. VOCNation.com. WCW Retro. Be sure to call in Thursday nights, 9 Eastern, on the VOC Nation Radio Network.
The worldwide leader in entertainment. This is the VOC Nation Radio Network.